the latest in this series of the 60th anniversary of Global Health Histories seminar series. It's nice to see some really friendly, familiar faces, and we've got some special familiar faces with us today. So I want to just take a moment to introduce or refer to my dear friend and colleague, Elizabeth Fee from the National Library of Medicine in the US. She's chief of the History of Medicine department there. And next to her is Professor Theodore Brown from Rochester University. And over here I have Professor Bernardino Fantini from the University of Geneva, Faculty of Medicine department. I could go on, but it's really great to have you here with us. Makes it that little bit extra special. I'd also like to introduce a couple of friends and colleagues from the Wellcome Trust, without whom we wouldn't be having this seminar at all, because our connections with the Wellcome Centre for the History of Medicine in London are in turn connected to the Wellcome Trust. So I'd like to introduce to you from the Wellcome Trust Dr. Elizabeth Shaw, who is Programme Manager for
Medical Humanities.
And Liz, would you like just to say a quick word about the Trust? Her colleague also, Niels, is with her, but I think, Liz, would you just say a few words on the Trust and the connection?
Yes, certainly, I'd be delighted to. I'll just spend a minute, if I may, just doing a thumbnail sketch of the Wellcome Trust. I'm aware that some people may not know much about it. We're an independent medical research charity, and we're funded with a private endowment that was set up on the death of our founder, Henry Wellcome, in 1936. So we've been going for some time now. Our asset base has increased over the years, and it now stands at $15 billion. So we have huge resources, which we're delighted to use in the furtherance of research in science and the medical humanities. And that asset base generates over £500 million a year for us to give out for various research projects. The majority of it goes to medical research. So we fund lots of research in things like mental health and neurosciences, public health, genetics, and so on. But $12 million of that money, I'm delighted to say, goes to funding research in the medical humanities, and that's Niels and my area. And that includes history of medicine, and the UCL unit is part of that, receives part of that funding. Biomedical ethics, we have a program in the UK and a developing country program. And we also fund lots of public engagement activities as well. And I've left some brochures at the back on the table there if anyone is interested in further details. And I'm sure Thompson can also put anyone in contact with us if they need any further information. And just briefly, I'd just like to tell you a bit about some of the direct activities that we fund. We've just opened a new venue in Euston Road in London, which is free to everybody, and we hope if you're in London, you'll come and see it. And that's it's called the Wellcome Collection, and it's a unique mix of galleries and events and conference facilities. The History of Medicine Library is also housed in the same building. And it's all about exploring the connections between medicine, life and art. And we've put on a couple of very well-received exhibitions recently. One was called the Heart, which actually is part one of the exhibits. We had a real-life heart donated by a young lady who'd had a heart transplant. And recently, Life Before Death, which was a very moving sort of photographic exhibition of people who, just before they died and just after, and also with some of their stories that they told to the interviewers just before they died. So very, very dramatic and very moving. So do come along. It's free at the Wellcome Collection, and I'm sure you'd find it very stimulating. We're delighted to be associated with this series of lectures. It's great to sort of reach out to new audiences. Many of the speakers of this series have actually received Wellcome Trust funding in the past, and some of them substantial funding. I think Mark has been very successful in getting funding from us, which is why he's here. We just hope you enjoy the series and come along to as many as you can, and do get in touch if you're interested in learning more about us. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. So I'm going to introduce our speaker, who's been standing there quietly. Mark Jackson is Professor of History at the and Director of the Centre for Medical History at Exeter University. He's written a number of books, and I won't take up too much time with the list of them, but one of them I have here, it's called Allergy, The History of a Modern Malady. And I'm told that the one that's coming not so far away from now is Asthma, The Biography, which he tells me spans a great deal of time, and as you put it, from Plato to NATO, the history
something
of
like
something
that.
Like it's something like that.
Further back than Plato and more recent.
So you can see that we're a little more recent today, and it sounds absolutely fascinating. We're recording this session. Mark will speak for 45 minutes or so, leaving, I hope, good time for some discussion and some questions. Thanks again, everybody, for being here, and my good friend Sanjoy, also from the Welcome Centre, without whom I don't think I'd get through these things. So, Mark, it's over to you, and I'm very glad to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that introduction, Thompson. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's a fantastic initiative that Sanjoy and Thompson have got going, and it's a pleasure to be part of it. As Liz said, I've also been fortunate to receive Wellcome Trust funding for my research for the early parts of my career, and I'm grateful for that, and so it's nice to have people from the Trust here as well to hear that. It's also a particular pleasure to be here because much of the research for this, certainly for the book on allergy and for the asthma book, was in fact done in the library in the archives here. Many years ago I crept in, I had great support from Carol and from the previous archivist, Mr. Masayutis, and I crept into the basement and sat in the office there and read through old WHO reports and archives. And my suspicion is that I don't know if this is change, I sense a change in the archives, but my feeling is that there are fantastic treasures in the archives that are important not just to historians but to epidemiologists and policymakers. And in fact, I hope that what I say today will show you some of the importance for a historical epidemiology that is both historically astute and linked to policy debates now as well. What I want to talk about today is really the character of asthma in the 20th century, particularly how that's changed, how the image of asthma, the experience of asthma, the social geography of asthma changed during the course of the 20th century. And I want to start off by saying something about early 20th century understandings and experiences of asthma through the lens, if you like, of the life of Marcel Proust, who in some ways is the archetypal asthmatic. Proust is perhaps one of the greatest French writers. He was born in Paris in 1871, started writing fairly early, had his first novel, Les Plaisirs et les Jours, published in 1896, but of course is best known for this magnificent seven-volume novel A la recherche du temps perdu, first translated into English as Remembrance of Things Past, which is a Shakespearean phrase that Proust himself disliked, and it became eventually in English In Search of Lost Time. Published over a period, the last two volumes were published by his brother, Robert, who was a urologist after Marcel's death. And running through, I don't know if any of you have read these novels, they're a mouthful or a readful, if you like. The novels are saturated with his preoccupations with love, with memory, and guilt. Proust died from pneumonia probably in 1922. But throughout his life, he suffered from asthma. His first attack was when he was 9 years old, walking in the Bois de Boulogne with his family. And from that moment onwards, he suffered regular and severe attacks of asthma and hay fever and a whole variety of other conditions that really shaped his life. He would at nighttime, when his asthma got worse, he would sit up or stand up and work. And when his asthma declined a little bit in the morning, he would go to bed. And for periods of his life, he would live in a single room, sleeping during the day and working at night, particularly after the death of his mother. And the incredible thing for historians, I suppose, of asthma, wanting to understand the experience of being asthmatic in the early 20th century, he described in detail his asthma, particularly in letters to his mother. He lived with his parents. His father died in 1903, his mother in 1905. He lived with his parents until 1905, and almost every day wrote a letter to his mother, even though he lived with her. Sometimes he would post it under her door when he got in for her to read in the morning, would leave letters around for her to read. And he described his health and his experience in great detail. Ma chère petite maman is how he always referred to her, and he would describe these are two letters from 1900 and 1901, an attack of asthma of unbelievable violence and tenacity, which would keep him up at night in the first instance. And even when he went away, he was very keen to go away to relieve his asthma. In fact, he came to Lake Geneva quite often. He would go to Evian or Tonon as health resorts to try and relieve his asthma. And sometimes when he went away, he was still seized with horrifying attacks of asthma. After his mother died, he would write to many of his friends. This is a letter to Marcel Boulanger, fellow author, again describing the ways in which asthma would grip him. He would cough, he would wheeze, he would gasp for breath so continuously that sometimes he couldn't do anything else. You get a very vivid picture of his asthma from his correspondence. And understandably, he tried almost every contemporary treatment to relieve his asthma. He tried most of the powders and the cigarettes contained stramonium. This was the standard treatment for asthma. Stramonium obtained from thorn apple, which was known by ancient Indian physicians many, many centuries, was incorporated into asthma cigarettes, particularly in the 19th century in Europe. And the Le Gras powders, Espic powders, Escoufleur powder fumigations were all forms of stramonium, which would be burnt and then the fumes would be inhaled. He tried all of those. He would, on the quote on the right, he would pass tobacconists by some anti-asthma cigarettes and smoke them as he went along to try and relieve his asthma. He also tried epinephrine, or adrenaline-type substances, caffeine, isolation. He lived in a cork-lined room. When his mother died, he moved into an apartment in Paris owned by his family, and he had built a cork-lined room, the aim of which was to keep out fumes, odors, pollen, dust, whatever it is that might be triggering his asthma. He also refused to have anybody cook in his apartment or to have any kind of cooking apparatus because the fumes, he thought, would trigger his asthma. He tried opium and morphine, which were again standard antispasmodic treatments for asthma in the late 19th, early 20th century. And as I've said, he would go sometimes when his parents were alive, with his parents, his grandmother and his mother particularly, to various sea, lakeside and mountain resorts to try and relieve his asthma. This was a constant refrain, both in his correspondence, but also in his creative writing, his novels as well. There are episodes where the main character, for example, in A la recherche du temps perdu, who also called Marcel, would have asthma. He'd describe the asthma and the various attempts that he'd made to treat it. So there's a correspondence in some ways. Proust always denied the possibility that that series of novels was autobiographical. But the correlation, the connection between his life and the kind of events in the novels is quite clear, particularly in the context of his illnesses. Now, the question is, you know, what am I telling you this for, in a sense, this image of an archetypal late 19th, early 20th century asthmatic? And one of the interesting things about asthma and hay fever and a variety of other diseases that Proust suffered from is that they were regarded at this time as nervous conditions more common in the educated, civilized upper classes. And in a sense, Proust embodied this elite aristocratic image of the asthmatic and hay fever sufferer. This is a quote from William Dunbar, who was an American physician working in the State Hygienic Institute in Hamburg at the time, pointing out that hay fever was very uncommon in savages, this was contemporary language, and in the lower classes. And that meant that we should regard hay fever and associated conditions like asthma as diseases of civilization. Some medical authors went further to suggest that in fact if you had hay fever, that should make you feel rather proud. It was a badge of honor that you should wear with pride. Men had it more than women because they were naturally more superior intellectually and in terms of culture. This was contemporary thinking. The West had it more than the East. The Americans and British had it particularly because we were the advanced civilized nations. The fact that we had hay fever, the fact that we sneezed when we saw a rose, was an emblem of our national intellectual superiority. This is Morell McKenzie's language in 1884. Now, the interesting thing about this Proustian image of hay fever and asthma, I want you to hold it in your minds, in a sense, this image of hay fever and asthma as elite aristocratic diseases in the early 20th century. Because if you move the story on to the late 20th century, I was looking at the WHO website recently, and one of the there's a big section on chronic diseases, one of which is asthma, and on that website it states very clearly that in the modern world, We believe that asthma is a disease that is more prevalent and more serious in low and middle to low income countries. And you can find this repeated, this kind of association, this class association, in national studies. This actually is not particularly convincing, but I'll show you another one in a minute. This is patients consulting general practitioners for asthma by social class in England and Wales in the 1990s, suggesting that there's some class bias, that the lower social classes, classes 4 and 5, manual workers, are more likely to consult their general practitioners for asthma than the higher social classes. Now, this is a measure, an indirect one, of morbidity. If you look at the figures for mortality, you see an even more striking gradient, class gradient. That is that in terms of mortality, the lower social classes through the 70s, 80s, and the bottom figure, the 90s, have a much higher standardized mortality ratio from asthma than the higher social classes. This is in direct contrast, if you like, to that Proustian elite image of asthma as a comfortable, familiar, cozy, aristocratic disease. There are other ways of breaking it down, and I'll say some more about this in a moment, about the relationship between asthma and race, or asthma and ethnicity, is that there are some studies in England and Wales suggesting that not only is there a distribution across classes, but also across ethnic groups as well. There are certain ethnic groups in developed countries particularly who suffer in terms of prevalence and mortality from asthma more often than the other groups. So the question I'm asking really today, and I want to address, is how do we explain this shift? What happened in the 20th century to transform asthma from an elite, aristocratic, fashionable, almost desirable disease at one level into something, a disease that is much more commonly linked with urban deprivation, social deprivation, and poverty? What are the factors that led to this reorientation of asthma, not as an elite Western disease, but as a global public health problem? And I'm going to look at four areas. I'm going to say something about rising trends in asthma and the impact of that on our understanding. I'm going to say something about mortality rates from asthma, race and asthma, and then say something about the development of asthma, not as a problem of Western developed countries, but as a problem of developing countries. And then I'll make some tentative solutions at the end, conclusions at the end. Let me start off by saying something about rising trends in asthma. One of the interesting things, if you go to the period when Proust was suffering from asthma, the last decade or so of the 19th century, the early 20th century, asthma was regarded as relatively rare. And while it was rare, it was possible to believe that it was an aristocratic, elite, civilized disease. But as clinical allergy began to emerge as a specialty, and clinicians, particularly in the States and in Britain, began to do surveys of their patients, they began to suggest that, in fact, asthma was on the rise. Some of the leading clinicians, Warren Vaughan was a leading American allergist in the interwar years, and he published books through the 30s and 40s suggesting that rather than this being a rare condition confined to the elite, this was in fact an incredibly common condition. He estimated, for example, that between 1 and 3.5 million people were suffering from asthma in the US in 41, 6 million hay fever sufferers, and 12 million patients needing treatment for allergies. This was not a rare, unique, privileged set of conditions. This was a set of conditions that could affect anybody. The graph on the right is from an American meta survey collating the information from various surveys done during the course of the 20th century, suggesting that if you plot them, then asthma prevalence, the proportion of the population suffering from asthma, was rising through the 20th century. And if you go on beyond Warren Vaughan into the post-Second World War period and look at developed countries, then you see much the same kinds of trends in asthma. This is taken from these are weekly incidence figures, so new cases reported by general practitioners between 1976 and 1993 in England and Wales, suggesting a fairly steady increase, not only in the overall prevalence, but in the number of new cases of patients with asthma during that period. And the same kind of figures you find in the States. This is a survey from an article published in 2002 looking at trends in asthma in childhood. It looks a fairly shallow graph at first look, but in fact, if you go from 1980, this is nearly 40 children per 1,000 children, so a prevalence of 3-4%, rising in the space of 15 years to 8%, so a doubling of asthma prevalence amongst children in America in the 80s and 90s. So you can see that throughout the course of the 20th century, the prevalence of asthma has risen steadily, continuously. Now, the point about this, in a sense, in the reorientation, the reframing of asthma, is that while asthma was rare, it was possible to believe in it as an elite aristocratic disease. It was confined to a few small proportion of the population. Once it began to spread, once the figures began to suggest that in fact this was a disease, a set of diseases that anybody could have, that elite image, that Proustian image of the aristocratic disease began to crumble. And people like Warren Vaughan were, for example, suggesting that the allergic diseases, including asthma, were no longer the exception, but the rule, that anybody, regardless of social class, ethnicity, race, religion, could get asthma. And that image, that as the social geography spread, it was no longer possible to believe in this Proustian image of asthma as an elite aristocratic disease. So one of the things that changed was a growing awareness, greater scientific and clinical knowledge of the distribution of asthma in developed countries, and an awareness that the prevalence was rising, which undermined or challenged the elite notions of Proust and his physicians. So the first point is that rising trends reoriented, reframed thinking and expectations about asthma. Let me say something about mortality, because it's quite clear that the approach to asthma and death changed dramatically during the 20th century as well. Prior to the mid-20th century, and you can go back through literature on asthma right to the ancient Greeks, through the medieval Jewish and Islamic scholars into the early modern period, and you can go east and west, and in most medical treatises historically, asthma was regarded as not only rare, but also rarely fatal, unless it was complicated by other diseases. In some cases in the medical literature, you see references to asthma complicated by consumption or dropsy or some other condition, some heart condition. And in fact, this is a quote from Walter Walsh, who was an English physician who wrote a textbook of chest diseases in 1871, who was saying, not only does it not kill you, but it actually protects you in some ways and allows you to live a long life. And this was very much like the image, the personality of gout in the 18th century, for example, which was a fashionable disease at that time, a badge of honor, an emblem of distinction, but also a disease that was thought to protect you from other more malign conditions. And asthma was bracketed, was portrayed in the same way. This was a disease that allowed you to live a long life, but also protected you against other conditions. And if you trends in asthma deaths are incredibly difficult to get hold of. It partly depends, of course, on how you define asthma and how reproducible and consistent those definitions were. There have been some attempts. This is, in fact, taken from a book by Neil Pearce, who is a prominent New Zealand researcher on asthma, suggesting that there was a fairly low level of mortality from asthma in the countries he looked at, and I'll come on to the reason why in a minute, when New Zealand, England and Wales and Australia rising during the 30s and 40s in New Zealand in particular, but a fairly steady, low level of mortality from asthma. But that changed very dramatically in the post-war years. And in some countries, during the late 50s, early 60s, there was a dramatic peak in asthma deaths. Asthma mortality, particularly amongst children, increased eightfold in a seven-year period between 1959 and 1966. The deaths from asthma increased from 1% to 7.2% of all deaths in the same age group. And by 1966, when the epidemic in England and Wales peaked, asthma had become the fourth commonest cause of death. Most clinicians at the time had been taught during the interwar years until the 50s and 60s, clinicians during their training were taught that asthma was not a fatal condition. This was a mild condition that was compatible with long life. And here, in the 1950s, was stark evidence to the contrary. Asthma overnight almost had become a killer. And there were a lot of attempts to explain this sudden surge of asthma deaths in certain countries. Partly people thought it might be due to a changing definition. Maybe what we were calling asthma once was now bronchitis, or bronchitis had become asthma, and maybe there was some classificatory change. That was dismissed, I think. And the clue to the reason behind the wave of asthma deaths was a series of comparative studies comparing New Zealand, England and Wales and Australia, which had very high epidemics, very prominent epidemics of deaths in the 1950s and 60s, with countries such as West Germany, Canada and the USA, which did not. And ultimately, I think the explanation was that it was to do with the treatment. People had begun to look at corticosteroids, for example, about whether there had been overuse of corticosteroids that might be involved. Eventually, the clue, I think, came from charting asthma deaths against the sales of certain types of beta agonists or bronchodilators. And in those countries that experienced a very prominent wave of asthma deaths, they had the highest sales of isoprenaline 40, a very high-dose inhaler, that had been overused by patients. Now, there are various ways of explaining the link between treatment and death in these cases. In some cases, it may have been because the overuse of the inhaler discouraged patients from going to see the doctor, and so there was a delay in seeking medical treatment. In some cases, it may have been direct toxicity on the heart. These were relatively early, relatively non-selective beta agonists that were cardiotoxic in high doses. And in some cases, there are suggestions that, in fact, overuse of certain types of inhalers made the asthma worse in some patients. Now, there are still ongoing disputes about this. So Neil Pearce has written a book on the story of New Zealand, because in New Zealand there was a second wave of asthma deaths in the 1970s and 80s, also linked to the consumption of a particular type of bronchodilator. And the decline in asthma deaths followed a warning from the Committee on Safety of Medicines in England in 1967, and then a removal of these drugs from over-the-counter. You could buy these over-the-counter. That was one of the problems in the 50s and 60s. People could just go back without going to their GP and talking about how bad their asthma was. They could go to the chemist, buy over-the-counter medication, and just use it liberally. And that was one of the problems. When the drugs were removed, when these inhalers were removed from the drug tariff, the wave of asthma deaths declined. Now, the point I want to make from this is not so much about the sort of dangers of treatment and the iatrogenic nature of the epidemic, but the fact that within the space of a very small number of years, in the late 1950s, early 1960s, the image of asthma was transformed quite dramatically, regardless of the cause of it, from a condition which most clinicians believe to be not only relatively uncommon, but also relatively mild. It had become a potential killer. One of the explanations for the wave of asthma deaths in some countries was the possibility that GPs up until that point simply did not recognize the potential severity and fatality of asthma. And after this, the image of asthma changed quite dramatically. Now it was no longer to hold on to this idea that it could prolong your life and it was a very nice, easy condition to have. It was potentially now a disease that could kill you. So in the space of a very short period of time, there was a transformation in the image and the understanding of asthma. Let me move on to a third issue. The interesting thing about the States is that there was no wave, there was no epidemic of asthma deaths in the States, and that was that although they had high-dose beta agonists, they tended not to use them in the same kind of way. The consumption of high-strength bronchodilators was not marked in the States. What they did have, though, is seasonal epidemics of asthma, particularly in some of the major cities, particularly in New York, Chicago, and New Orleans. There were waves of asthma deaths in the autumn and the winter particularly, which were sometimes referred to by inhabitants as the fifth season. This was the season when asthma hit. And some of the early studies were in New Orleans. This is work done largely by Greg Mittman, who's a fantastic environmental historian who's written a book on asthma and allergies in the States. And he charts the ways in which in some of the American cities it became apparent during the 50s, 60s and 70s that those areas of those cities that were suffering from higher prevalence from asthma and increased mortality were the deprived neighborhoods, usually the neighborhoods where either Afro-Americans or Puerto Ricans, for example, were living. And this shaded area around the Charity Hospital is where the Charity Hospital drew most of its patients. Now, it's the interesting thing about the race and asthma debate is that the earliest explanation for the link between race and asthma was a psychological one. This is a report from the Times in England in 1965, reporting an outbreak of asthma in Afro-American and African and Puerto Rican populations in New York. And this is the kind of story that was told very early on in the 60s about asthma and race. And the argument here is that it was a psychosomatic illness linked to tensions arising from conditions concerning race relations and the civil rights movements. Now, in some ways, this was a standard explanation. The link between asthma and emotions was known right back to Hippocrates. Writers on asthma had always said that violent passions of the mind could trigger an asthma attack. But during the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, there was a strong interest, particularly in Britain and the States, in reading asthma as a psychological condition, as a condition triggered by a disordered psyche. There was a lot of psychoanalytical interest in asthma as the archetypal psychosomatic condition. This was the condition, above all, in which you could relate psychological disturbance to physical experience. So in some ways, you can see this explanation as fitting neatly with the preoccupation in the 40s, 50s, and 60s with the psychology of asthma. In a curious way, of course, it's an inversion of the Proustian image, because Proust was suffering from asthma as an elite, cultured, civilized person. These were people suffering from asthma because they were disturbed in some kind of way. And in some of the literature, in fact, you see references to the damaged black psyche. This was a sense in which there was some racial inferiority that made them vulnerable. It was a complete inversion. It was a psychological explanation, which was also used to explain Proust's asthma. But it was an inversion of that Proustian image in a way in which there was a damaged racial psyche that predisposed certain people to asthma. Most of those early explanations were dismissed by allergists and respiratory physicians working with the patients. They looked also at urban air pollution. But what began to become apparent, particularly this was a series of research done in Washington, was that they began to suggest that among certain immigrant communities living in slum areas in the big American cities had a high proportion of people with cockroach sensitivity. And the debate moved away from the psychological to the material environment in which these people lived, and the suggestion was that as a result of quite severe and striking environmental inequalities, these ethnic groups were living in inferior housing infested with cockroaches and other organisms, and the asthma that they were experiencing was triggered by cockroach sensitivity. Now, in some American literature, that was still played in racist terms. This was about immigrant communities being dirty in some ways, not looking after their housing, not being clean. What emerged was that this was a problem of the landlords not keeping up the quality of the housing, failing to improve the quality of the housing, and allowing these ethnic groups largely to inhabit uninhabitable, very deprived housing stock. So in a sense, the interesting thing about the asthma epidemic, it starts off being described in psychological terms in a traditional way, but became very quickly a story about urban deprivation, about social inequalities, and about the exposure of certain groups to environmental triggers in particular ways. And those waves of deaths in those New York inner city areas and Chicago and New Orleans in particular, only began to decline as the result of new housing. The slum areas were destroyed and new housing was provided. Medicaid, allergy and asthma outpatient clinics made treatment more feasible for some of those ethnic groups, and then the emergence, the introduction of new asthma drugs. But again, in a sense, the point I want to make is that this wave of asthma deaths during the 50s, 60s and 70s in certain American cities undermined quite strongly this image of asthma as an elite condition. This was now construed by most allergists and respiratory physicians as a disease of poverty, as a disease that was linked to class, but in the opposite way than that Proustian image of the elite civilized groups. This was now, in many people's eyes, a product of social deprivation, not social exclusivity in terms of cultured civilization. The final point I want to make, the broad area, is about global trends in asthma. For most of the 20th century, certainly through the late 19th, early 20th century, most people believed that asthma was only a problem of the developed world. And this was true of allergies generally, is that these were diseases that were more common and more of a socioeconomic and public health burden in America and Europe, for example. And I think that began to change largely as a result of the World Health Organization. The WHO, of course, was set up in the wake of the Second World War and began to develop, particularly in the late 1950s and 1960s, an interest in setting up specialist research units. And the first of those, started in 1963, was the Immunology Unit, directed first by Howard Goodman and then by Giorgio Trigiani. And the aim of the immunology unit was partly to develop training and research and education centres throughout the world. So they set up centres, for example, in Ibadan, in Sao Paulo, in Mexico, in Lausanne, and so forth. So they, these were dedicated immunology research centres to train immunologists partly, but also to carry out research. And this is where I'm drawing on the stuff that I the work I did in the archives here, because there are tremendous records of the focus and the interest of the WHO in establishing these research centres. Now, most of the immunology unit's remit was infectious diseases. This was really the focus, and most of their reports are about the approaches to infectious diseases, eradicating or controlling infectious diseases. But part of their remit was clinical immunology and immunopathology, and as part of that, they were interested, the unit was interested in allergies. For most of the 60s and 70s, it was felt, particularly by the directors, that there was insufficient knowledge to really chart allergies in the developing world. But by the mid-1970s, Alain de Weck, who was head of the Clinical Institute for Clinical Immunology in Bern, decided that he would send out a questionnaire to all countries that had immunological societies or allergy societies. And he sent out a questionnaire in the mid-70s, it was 76 it went out, asking people to return information about how many patients in their country had asthma, how many had other types of allergies, how many clinical allergists there were, what kind of clinical facilities there were. And this was followed up, the results of that survey were collated here at the WHO, and it was followed up by two meetings, the first convened in Geneva here in 1978 and the second in Florence in 1984, looking at the global burden of allergic diseases and approaches to treatment. So this was this period, the 70s, was the first when people began to look much more closely at allergies, including asthma, in developing countries. And what came out of those surveys of Alain de Weck's work and those meetings was very interesting. Because the first issue, I think, was that people had underestimated the burden of allergies, including asthma, in developing countries. The assumption was that this was an elite condition. It was a hangover of that Morrell McKenzie image of hay fever and asthma as this is elite white men in the civilized world that suffered from it. And what came out of this was that that image was no longer tenable. This was a disease that was also asthma and other allergic diseases that were much more common in the developing world than people had assumed before. And also the expectation was, and I'll come back to this explanation in a bit, is that the prevalence of asthma in the developing world was expected to increase as they began to take on Western industrial urbanized lifestyles. So two broad conclusions, I think, came out of Alain de Weck's work, alerting people to the possibility that allergic diseases could be a major public health and socioeconomic problem in many developing countries. And I'll give you some examples of the kind of figures. I'm going to say something very briefly. I'm going to look at many of the many parts of the developing world and see the same kind of story in the conferences in 78 and 84. Many contributors from developing parts of the world came and gave their figures in relation to asthma and other conditions. And these are just taken. I'm going to say something more about India speculatively in a moment. But you can see the kind of pattern is that in many of these countries, up until the 50s and 60s, asthma and hay fever had never been described in some of these countries. There had been no asthma reported. And yet within the space of 10 or 20 years, 7, 10, 15, 20% of the population of some of these countries were showing signs of asthma in the kind of surveys that Alain de Weck and the WHO were carrying out. And the story is much the same for most countries, is that countries who up until the Second World War had not identified asthma as a major health problem were beginning to see in the 60s and 70s rising levels of asthma. Japan is striking. In a sense, the asthma prevalence certainly doubled between the 50s and the 70s. In the 1930s, it's interesting, there were some studies done of Japanese people, families living in California, which showed that many of the children had hay fever at a time in the 30s when hay fever had not been described in Japan, and it was assumed that it was not a problem. By the 1980s, 33% of children in Japan were reported to be suffering from hay fever. And the explanation that was running through these figures, behind these figures used to explain them, was that this was some factor in Western lifestyles. This was a product of Westernization, whether it's diet, whether it's pollution, whether it's housing, whatever it might be, that there's a factor in Westernization, industrialization, that was driving this rise in asthma. Now, I'm going to say something about India, because India is an interesting... I'm hesitant, because I know there'll be people who know more about India than me, and Sanjoy is sitting here as an exemplary world-class historian of Indian medicine, and so what I have to say is speculative, Sanjoy, and if any information on it would be very nice. But India is interesting, because superficially, it seems to support the trend and the epidemiological explanation, this rising trends in asthma, and the sense in which it's about urbanization and westernization. Most of the official studies of asthma in India in the 1950s, 1960s, there was an official study, a government study in Delhi, suggesting that the prevalence in 1961 was 1.8%. Viswanathan did a study in Patna in 1966, again a very similar kind of prevalence of 1.76%. During the 1990s, there were one or two internationally driven surveys of asthma in India, suggesting that the prevalence was rising slightly, 3.5 to 6%. There were two big surveys in the mid-90s, one saying 3.5%, one 6%. By the late 90s, the surveys of asthma across India were suggesting a much higher prevalence, up to 15% in some of the surveys. And superficially, that tells the same kind of story. You have a developing country with very low rates of asthma until the 1960s, 1970s, then begins to modernize in certain ways, adopting in some cases, in some places, in some parts, a Western lifestyle, and the asthma levels, the asthma prevalence starts to rise. I think, though, that there's an important caveat, an important lesson in the Indian story here, that the story, this simple description of rising levels in developing countries, and the explanation that it's clearly to do with westernization or urbanization is problematic. It's a much more complex story that can be told that needs to be much more sensitive to regional and cultural specificity. This is my anxiety about the Indian figures. If you look at these official figures in the 1960s, most of them have a very low prevalence of asthma. When you read the Indian medical journals and the reports in the journals, most clinicians are claiming that asthma is a very common condition, although the official reports don't record that. And the story seems to be that nobody diagnosed, although people suffered, they might have suffered from asthma, but nobody diagnosed it. And there are two possible reasons for it, two ways of looking at it. One is that when a child, for example, came to a clinician with a wheeze and a cough, there were other things to think about than asthma, tuberculosis, for example, or other respiratory infections. And what happened, it would appear, to many of these children is they were diagnosed primarily. The first thing the clinician would think of is a respiratory tract infection, and that would be what would often go down, and they would be treated for that without anybody thinking asthma was too low down the list of respiratory pathogens, if you like, mechanisms, and so it was not often diagnosed. The other important thing is that there were cultural perceptions of asthma that make reading these figures very difficult. The asthma historically in India has been stigmatized in some populations, in the sense that it was a stigmatized disease, it was a taboo disease. People didn't want to have asthma, partly because of perceptions that it was contagious, partly because it was a chronic disease that was thought to be untreatable. Parents did not want their children diagnosed with asthma because of the possible repercussions. So what would happen is, the patient would go, parents would go to the doctor, and there's some nice anthropological studies by an American scholar, David Van Sickle, on this, looking at asthma in the last 10 or 20 years in India, suggesting that when a patient came to a doctor, the doctor, if they wanted to keep that patient as one of their patients, were paying for their care, would not give them a diagnosis of asthma because they were anxious that would alienate the parents and they wouldn't come back. So they would give them a diagnosis of wheezy bronchitis or allergic bronchitis or house dust mite allergy. And there's a nice story in David's work which suggests that in Chennai, the asthma clinic recruited very few patients. When they changed it to a wheezy child clinic, everybody came with their patients because they no longer had the stigma of having asthma as their label. So my point is this, that in a sense, these developing world figures look very reassuring. They fit this nice, neat story of westernization, urbanization, industrialization. The developing world is catching up with its asthma, and it still has that sort of, you know, that hints of Proustian superiority about it, that kind of argument. In fact, I suspect that the story may be much more complex than that, and that most of the developing world figures probably underestimated the prevalence of asthma precisely because they didn't take into account the regional cultural specificity of the study areas. Now, I personally think that is not only is not simply an academic historical argument about reading these things. It has important epidemiological implications because it challenges the very easy assumption that we make about westernization driving asthma levels and allergic diseases. It may, in fact, that we need to look at other explanations. It may, if we've underestimated the prevalence of asthma in some developing countries, we have to think about whether our model of westernization, modernization, and urbanization can still explain the pattern and the spread and the prevalence of asthma globally. And that, in a sense, is a call to arms for historians and epidemiologists and policymakers to think more carefully and talk together, perhaps, more about what these figures might mean. I'm going to finish. Have I something coming on? Thank you very much, Carol. I've undone a lead here. Bear with me. Bear with Carol. I have only one slide, so it's not fatal.
I've been watching you step on.
Sorry about that. You should have shouted at me.
Thanks, Carol.
There we are. This is my final slide. And on the left is my family. And we were enjoying a day out at the Science Museum in Montreal. And I was working over there in the archives on stress. And this, I have a number of allergies and I have asthma. My wife, you can see her in the shade in the background, has no allergies. I think she's allergic to me occasionally, but beyond that, I think she is allergy free. The children have multiple allergies, all have hay fever and various things. The two boys have quite severe asthma, they've been hospitalized for it. And Reardon, the older of the two boys, has quite severe drug allergies as well. And the point I want to make is that it's very comforting, it's very reassuring, it's very tempting to believe in the Proustian image of asthma as a disease, as an aristocratic disease. This is, my kids have asthma because they're very intelligent, they're cultured, they're civilized, they're superior, whatever it might be. However tempting it is to believe that, that is simply not tenable given the history of asthma and the impact and the image of asthma during the course of the 20th century. And that is partly because of surveys like this on the sort of Kandinsky-esque illustration taken from a paper by Begg and Bamberg. It's a very interesting paper, published in 2005, I think it is, in Environmental Health Perspectives. The paper is in fact attempting to suggest that rising prevalence of asthma is a result of anthropogenically driven climate change, a sort of speculative paper about the ways in which asthma and climate change might be linked. But what it reminds us, in a sense, this is the image I want to leave you with, in a sense, is that wherever you look in the world, however you define asthma in the world, and that's, of course, a very big topic, levels have risen. It's no longer possible to believe, as I'd like to, that my children have asthma because they're elite and superior, because everybody is now vulnerable to asthma. And in many ways, if you look at the social geography of the disease, what we have learnt over the last century from the kinds of studies and the kind of investigations I've been talking about, is that the social geography of asthma has changed quite dramatically. It is now much more often a disease of social deprivation, of exposure to environmental pollutants linked to other factors. It's no longer tenable to believe that this is the product of culture and civilization. It's a very different image, if you like, of asthma than the one embodied in Marcel Proust. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Mark.
You're welcome.
Very good. That was, we're in good time for some discussion here, and I'm going to open that in a second. I just wanted to say I'm very pleased to see the mix today. We've got some of the best historians in health and medicine that there are. We've got some very nice senior staff people, we've got others, and I think we've got a few interns. Can I see how many interns there might be here? I just want to say I'm really pleased that you come to these things. I think it's very good that we should encourage you to join in discussions like this, and I hope that you find something valuable and useful from them. Personally, I've just thoroughly enjoyed that. I've learned so much. It's been a great trip, you know, and it's a trip across time and across the world, and I've learned a great deal from it. So thank you very, very much for that. And I would like to, I know that Mark's favourite part of this seminar is to hear your comments and your questions and to get a good discussion going. So, who wants to be first? Now, it's a close thing between this lady and Pam, and because I know her first, I'll ask you.
thank you.
Just tell us who you are and.
Yes, my name is Mika Kawano. I'm working in international health regulation, and I'm from Japan. And so there was something about the data in Japan, and I think I'm going to say the same thing. Is there a possibility that it's just that hay fever was not picked up?
Yep.
Among the poor population, both in the case of Japan and also in the case of Proust.
Yes. It's a really good question, and hay fever is perhaps a more interesting case study than asthma in that sense, because it has a much shorter history. There are some suggestions that hay fever was identified in the 10th century in a text by Rhazes. There was a description. But most of the histories of hay fever suggest that it was first written about extensively by John Bostock, who was an English physician in 1819, describing his own hay fever, in fact. And it was only ever diagnosed largely in upper-class private patients. And you find, in fact, in the 19th and early 20th century, doctors writing that when they are dealing with the poor in the outpatient dispensaries, they never come across a case of hay fever. And you're absolutely right that it is very difficult to read that in a simple way as saying there was no hay fever in the lower social classes, because it may well be that the same kind of symptoms were diagnosed as a cold or some kind of respiratory tract infection. And so you're absolutely right that there are problems with how they were diagnosed and how you read that. I suppose my interest, though, is that one of the drivers of that diagnostic pattern is the social image that hay fever and asthma had very early on in their history, in their biography, if you like, there's a very close association between the biological categories, the diagnostic categories, and cultural perception. And in a sense, this is part of my argument in the book on allergies, is that if we look at the rising levels of allergies, we have to see that as both a biological and a cultural issue. And you're absolutely right that in some cases and in some parts of the world, and this is part of the story about India, is that if we're going to tell that story convincingly, we have to be sensitive to the social and the cultural context in which the diagnosis was being made. I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Thanks. Pamela and then Bernardino.
I find it very interesting. I also suffer from asthma, more an allergic asthma.
Yep.
And always in springtime, till about now, I'm pretty bad. This year I wasn't, and of course I've sort of looked to sort of more alternative therapies and so on. There's, I don't know if you've thought very carefully about nutrition, because I immediately saw a link of why, for example, it was an aristocratic disease previously, because they had a very much richer diet.
Yep.
Who were people who would be eating more raw food, more simple food.
Yep.
Nowadays, McDonald's, is there any link as to, you know, fast foods, etc., and of course people of a lower class will be more...
Yep.
Now, I went on a liver cleanse diet this year, and I did not suffer from my allergies with springtime. So I'm wondering if you could...
It's a really good question, because I think the links between nutrition... There's a lot talked about the links between nutrition and asthma and other allergies, and I think we simply don't know enough about it. There is. The interesting thing is that there have been some studies I think they were done in Africa, on rural communities, on children moving from a rural to an urban community and suffering from vastly increased levels of allergies, including allergic asthma. The explanation that was chosen was precisely the one that you're suggesting, that they were eating a different diet. They were eating a diet full of a pre-packed, processed food that has different ingredients in, for a start, is not produced locally. And that is one possible explanation, certainly also, as you say, for the historical trends across classes. I think diet is possibly one of the major factors.
Because it's the burden on the liver so you have the pollution on one side, so if you reduce at least that burden by what you take in yourself, you're then not going
no,
to...
I think there's a very strong strand of research like that. There used to be a quip about allergies in New Zealand, that there was no allergy in New Zealand until they introduced margarine. They had butter before that, locally produced butter from all the farming and so forth, and that was a much healthier lifestyle. Margarine was introduced in 1974 or whenever it was, and then suddenly New Zealand had loads of... Now, in a sense, it's a facile quip, because I think there are other ways of explaining New Zealand asthma, but it may be that there's something very important in that as our diet has changed quite dramatically, then certain new diseases have emerged. The class issue historically with hay fever and asthma is there's been another way of explaining it, which of course is the hygiene hypothesis, which was put forward by David Strachan in 1989, and this is the suggestion that the smaller family size, the less cross infections children get, and their immune system develops in abnormal ways to promote allergies. So it's about immunotolerance, essentially the development of tolerance or sensitivity. And he used it historically, he looked at hay fever in fact, that was the case study, to suggest that in fact the aristocratic families in the past through the 19th century were those families who were able to limit family size first, who tended, their family size tended to drop earliest, their children didn't get infections, and so they developed these abnormal allergic immune responses. And it may also be something, you're absolutely right, about diet. I think historically that has not been looked at a great deal. I think there are big studies in the late 20th century about diet. But I think the territory is quite complex because there are a lot of different potential explanations for that historical and geographical and class shift. But I suspect that there are most researchers in the field of allergies are interested in diet, and I don't think we know enough about it, I have to say, yet. But there are a lot of suggestions that certain types of diet, adopting a certain diet will change the manifestation of allergic diseases.
And there seemed to be such an increase post-war
everywhere.
I wonder if that has anything to do with the nuclear bombs that went off.
Well, that's a very interesting question as well, because there's a lot of research on environmental pollution, but mostly on visible pollution. It's the smoke, the choking cities sort of thing, and much less on some of the other possible pollutants to which certain populations are exposed differentially. And again, I think that probably not enough has been done on that. In the same way that there are some studies suggesting that vehicle exhaust fumes, for example, which are largely invisible now, are a major factor in the distribution, but again, that has not been substantiated. I mean, there are some suggestions, I think, both in the laboratory experimental setting and in environmental studies, but I think we probably don't have the knowledge to draw clear conclusions about that yet.
Thanks. Bernardino, Liz, gentleman over there, Human.
Thank you. I have first imagine a comment on your first part, and then a more substantial question about the last conclusion. You mentioned the Marcel Proust's letter to his mother, and I wonder why he didn't write to his father.
Yeah.
Because Marcel's father was Adrian Proust,
yeah,
a physician,
yeah,
one of the founder of International Health.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. Yes, he participated to many international conferences, and he published many books on public hygiene,
yep,
and international hygiene.
We're learning a lot extra today, thanks.
Marcel wrote to his mother, not to his father.
Yep.
We can find psychoanalytic,
yes, indeed,
reasons for that.
Yep.
But it's very interesting. My question is, as you mentioned, asthma was considered as an aristocratic disease, and that meant at that time to be also a familial disease,
yes,
linked to particular,
yep,
families.
Yep.
So there was probably, in the language of the 19th century, the constitutional basis of,
yep,
it, and now we would say a hereditary or genetic predisposition,
yep,
as probably in your family, I don't know.
Yep.
But in a period in which we are looking for the genetic and molecular basis of every disease, what is the present,
yep,
status of this debate?
No, two very good questions. The issue about Proust's father is interesting, because Proust's father, in fact, wrote a preface also to a textbook on nervous diseases in, I can't remember when it was published, 1890 something, I think. And so he was knowledgeable about the kinds of diseases, the nervous diseases that Proust was suffering from. And he had a very close relationship with his mother, you're absolutely right, Proust, and that is one of the ways in which his diseases were explained, as indeed his homosexuality. And he was quite reticent about that until his mother died, although it became apparent much more later. And that is one of the ways that psychoanalytical psychobiographies have tried to explain Proust. His father, I suspect, and this comes from a very short quote in one of his letters, that the rest of his family, apart from his mother, believed his maladies to be imagined. He recounts a story in one of his letters where he is forced to get in a car to go back from somewhere with some family members, and he's saying, I can't possibly do it because my asthma is very bad, my hay fever is very bad, and they're saying, for Christ's sake, just get on with it. You know, you're just imagining it all. It's not real. Don't worry about it. And his sense in his letters is the impression it gives is that his mother is a much more receptive personality to his hypochondria, whichever way you want to look at it, or his illness. And so much has been made. I think you're absolutely right. The other thing, of course, is that he drew from his father and his brother, who was a surgeon, a urologist, information. He would write to his brother and say, look, I've heard, this is a very interesting one, actually, there were stories about, and there still are stories about, parasitic worms being a cure for asthma. And he would hear odd stories like this about new treatments and ask if he'd write to his brother and say, look, I've heard this new thing. What do you think of it? Shall I try it? So he used his brother and his father to draw in his construction of his own diseases. But he always felt the suggestion in his letters is that his family, apart from his mother, regarded it as imaginary hypochondriasis, essentially. I think probably there is more to say about that. I don't think he didn't get on with his father, which is perhaps what the psychoanalysts might like. I think he had quite close relations with his father and his brother, but he found much more sympathy and support from his mother, I think, in terms of his experience of disease. The question about the familial constitutional aspect of asthma and allergies is interesting because historically, you know, way back to Hippocrates and Galen and Areteus describing asthma in ancient Greek texts, there was a recognition that this was something that was familial in some sense. And that is a constant refrain in debates about asthma through time, is this sense in which there's a constitutional element which runs through families. That didn't probably become, in terms of a clear research agenda, that didn't become prominent, I think, until the identification of allergy and the allergic constitution, a very strong sense in which, for example, in the 1922 paper, defining atopy, that predisposition to allergic reactions, from that moment on, the constitutional aspect of it became absolutely crucial. But I think the different, I'm telling a slightly different story. And I think that most clinicians would understand that there's a constitutional element, there's a hereditary predisposition to manifesting allergic reactions, but that is not sufficient to explain the dramatic increase in prevalence in the 20th century, because that has been too sharp. The argument is that the dramatic increase in allergies in the 20th century is too rapid to invoke a genetic explanation. It may be that the genetic basis is important in the manifestation, but in terms of the epidemiological pattern, people have preferred to look at environmental explanations. I don't think they're dismissing the genetic, and there are one or two people who have claimed to find the gene for asthma. There was a story 10 or 15 years ago by some Oxford researchers saying that identified the gene, and I think everybody would accept that there's a complex genetic component to the manifestation, but that the rising prevalence has to be explained in environmental terms, I think.
Thank you. Liz?
I was wondering a couple of things. Whether there may be some differences in attitudes towards asthma and allergies.
Yeah.
I grew up most of the time in Ireland and then moved to the United States. And I remember at the time, it struck me very forcibly that I had never known anyone with allergies in Ireland, but when I came to the United States, everybody I met had allergies of some kind or another, sometimes multiple ones. And I do recall being made to feel a little inferior because I had no allergies.
Yeah, no allergies. Yeah.
So it may be that some of this sort of class sophistication, development, civilization attitude. Is still there with allergies, even though asthma itself has changed its image. If that's true, it would kind of add a nice little twist to your argument.
I think you're right, that there may be a distinction that needs to be made. I mean, most most cases of asthma, 70-80%, are probably understood to be allergic in origin. So there's a heavy overlap, but not everything that's asthmatic is allergic. You're absolutely right about that. I suppose, in a sense, my reading of the history of allergy, that if you look at the first part of the 20th century, the archetypal allergic disease was hay fever. That was the disease that most people studied. That's the one they wanted to cure. That was the one that they thought was aristocratic and civilized. In the second half of the 20th century, I think the archetypal, the most important socioeconomic and public health point of view, has become asthma. But you're right that it's become slightly disjoined from allergies. The reason why they're often discussed together, and I suppose I do it as well, is that is conceptually, from the late 19th century, asthma and hay fever were almost talked about in the same breath. In fact, it was called hay asthma, and hay fever were the terms in the late 19th, early 20th century. But you're right, in terms of the image and the personality, that allergy has probably continued to have an elite image, if you like, an aristocratic image. And you see it particularly in a couple of areas. In fact, if you look at the figures for hay fever and class, for example, the ones I showed about aspirin in general practice in Britain, is that in fact there is still a slight class distribution, with more class 1 sufferers from hay fever, or claiming to suffer from hay fever, than class 5. That's one aspect. The other area you see it discussed, at least, is in food allergies, where in some cases you can see trends and fashions for being allergic, because it suggests a refined palate, a cultured, sensitive personality, and you still have those hangovers of that elitist image of those kinds of diseases. And I think what's happened with respect to asthma is that these episodes that I've talked about, the association with race, the association with death, the association with class, the spreading of it, has decoupled it, and uncoupled it in some way from what are still probably elitist images of the allergies in some ways. I think it's a very fair point. Yeah.
Gentlemen there, sorry, I beg your pardon,
little,
carry on.
Okay. Question. I was interested in this paper on climate change and asthma, whether there's any plausible mechanism that could...
The idea that they promote in that paper is that global warming increases the production and allergenicity of ragweed pollen, and that is... Now, it's speculative, because in fact most of the studies show that pollen levels have fallen over the last 30 or 40 years because of industrialization and urbanization. The suggestion they're putting forward here is that man-made, human-made climate change has been responsible for changing pollen production and allergenicity, and that is something that hasn't been looked at. That is the argument they make. It's a speculative discussion paper, which is quite interesting, I think, setting up a challenge for the epidemiologists and the environmentalists to try and look more closely at the relationship between climate change and disease.
Okay, I've got three more I know of, at least. Gentleman who's been patiently waiting there, Hooman, and then Ted after that. Do you still have a question?
Yes,
please.
Somehow, I can't get my equation right, because the origin of this, that's sort of complex origin of this, they seem to be awfully conflictual.
Yep.
On the one hand, we've got the idea that social class determines asthma, lower social class, though, but then the sanitation has increased with industrialization. And industrialization, actually, all the main allergens, which are actually associated nowadays with a healthy rural lifestyle, pollens, fruit, and grasses, have declined.
Yep.
And somehow this just does not paint a very harmonious picture, that over the last couple of years there has been an increase, even though, and especially in the poor, although the main allergens actually are, you know, a healthy lifestyle, and they have been going down, as you just said.
It's a really interesting question. It's a very complex equation, as you say, and I'm not convinced we understand it fully. The argument about industrialization is that a certain environmental pollutants, and you're absolutely right that in some ways the environment has been cleaned up in many important ways, and intuitively one thinks, okay, we should be getting less of these things. The argument is that there are new types of environmental pollutants, some of which are unseen, like vehicle exhaust fumes, for example, which are acting as catalysts or triggers at some level for allergic sensitivity. So if you have the allergic sensitivity and you're breathing in a polluted atmosphere and you're exposed to certain allergens, then you'll get asthma. But what we mean by pollution, of course, has changed. Many of the visible pollutants in modern cities have got better, and there may be other types of environmental triggers or environmental pollutants. So that's one possible explanation that people have looked at. I mean, the interesting studies were done in the reunification of Germany, because in the German studies, the expectation was that in East Germany, the levels of allergy would be much higher because of polluted, heavily polluted German city. And what it actually showed was that as East Germany became more West German, the levels of allergies increased, including asthma. And the suggestion was, the argument here seems to be that it's something about the overly clean, sanitized, hygienic lifestyle of modern Western cities. So the irony is that modern hygiene, modern sanitation measures have cleaned up the environment in many ways. We don't have the infectious diseases largely that we had before. What we have in their place is an abnormally developing, a set of children with abnormally developing immune systems that are predisposed not only to allergies, in fact, but also to autoimmune diseases. And there was recent reports that childhood leukemia, certain types of hematological disorders, might also be linked to this kind of aberrant immune system. So the story, you're absolutely right, is incredibly complex and in some ways counterintuitive. But it seems to be, the argument appears to be, that either there are new forms of pollutants which are affecting modern cities, and although we've cleaned up a lot of the environment, there are new forms of pollutant, or it is, and this of course contradictory in some ways as you say, is that an overly sanitized lifestyle is in fact encouraging the development of immune disorders, not just of allergies and asthma.
But then the question is, why is it in fact, why is it of a major burden among still the lower
socioeconomic? I agree entirely. Well, I suspect that there's a political environmental explanation for that, is that those people, the lower social classes and those people living in deprived situations are still carrying the heaviest burden of certain types of pollutants, for example. And I think there's a political story about the production and consumption of pollution that is not being told, that hasn't been told yet. I suspect that there's a politics, a geopolitical story about patterns and spread of pollutants or different lifestyles. I mean, the point about the diet was interesting, because I don't think anybody, again, has looked particularly closely about the at the differential consumption of certain types of foodstuff as well, across not just national boundaries, but geopolitical boundaries and class boundaries. And again, the story becomes one, if you like, of deprivation or exposure to certain types of triggers, I think. But I think, I mean, I take your point, because I read recently there was a book published called Rising Trends in Asthma, which was the product of a conference, it was about 5 or 10 years ago, of everybody in the world who knew about asthma. And I reviewed the book for a British medical journal, thinking, thank God, I'm going to find out what the argument is now. I'm going to understand asthma. I read the whole book. I didn't understand at the end of it, because they were all taking contradictory positions, arguing for different things, and actually the story is phenomenally complex and very difficult to get your head around. I sympathise entirely, because I don't understand it either.
Thanks. Women? And then Ted.
I think we sort of touched on what I was going to say, but I mean, I take the point that there are cultural differences in diagnoses and all that, and
yep.
Also the point about underdiagnosis and with modern systems, things are diagnosed better. But I couldn't have a sort of simpler explanation of what you presented be the fact that if asthma is linked to some factors or multiple factors, or caused by multiple factors, linked to modernity,
yeah,
whatever aspect, whether they're environmental or nutrition, that's not the point, but something about modern society that is linked, then you would expect that the first people to be affected would be the elites.
Yes.
Both in Europe, yep, and later in the developing world, as that aspect, whatever it was, reached them. And then as more and more people have become,
yep,
exposed to whatever these factors are, and now worldwide and globally, everyone's basically been,
yep,
exposed, and therefore whatever is going has gone through society,
yep,
and that what you're now seeing is that you have it more in the poor, but that's basically any chronic condition. You have people,
yep,
the poor have it,
yep,
more than,
yep,
than the wealthy and the rich, so,
yep,
it's gone through the I mean,
yep,
their education, better access,
yep,
in, to healthcare or whatever, there's less in,
yep,
in the higher classes,
yep,
and more in the poor classes,
yep,
as any chronic,
yep,
chronic condition, and that's the basic explanation, although there are all these other things,
yep,
about social perceptions and underdiagnosis, yep, as well going on.
I take that's a really good point, and you're absolutely right that the kind of pattern, those diseases of affluence that are always constructed as disease of affluence, and you could say heart disease, diabetes, certain types of cancer, allergies, rheumatic conditions and so forth, which manifest themselves at least earliest in the higher social classes, are really all now the inverse of that. They're not disease of affluence, they are disease of poverty. The burden, the prevalence, and the mortality as well as morbidity from those conditions is much higher in the low social classes, and you're absolutely right. And there are and there are whole ways of explaining that that touch on modernization, industrialization, access to healthcare facilities, exposure to certain types of triggers. I think you're absolutely right. I suppose my point about the Indian figures, for example, is that that's a very neat explanation in some ways, and it may well be right, but it's just a little bit of a warning that actually those figures need to be read very carefully, that the official statistics measuring levels of terms. One of my arguments in the allergy book, for example, is that we have more allergy now because we know more about it. We have more allergy because we diagnose it more. We have more allergy because people, the doctors, the media, the patients are much more sensitive to it. That there is also, at the same time, as sometimes a very clear environmental biological explanation, a cultural aspect of the story that needs to be told quite carefully. I think that was my point. I didn't want to use that to completely undermine the modernization, but just to sound a warning bell that these things have to be read quite carefully. I think the estimates of the low levels of asthma in developing countries have been skewed by a failure to recognize the cultural and regional specificity of the disease, if you like.
Thanks. Ted?
Two quick things. I remain troubled about whether this is a secular trend or whether there is, in fact, a diagnostic underreporting and an epidemiologic artifact, and I think that's a very complex and troubling issue.
Yep.
But just to pick up on this issue of modernization, there's yet another dimension to modernization. It's the modernization of medical cultures. Take your East German, West German example with a sudden sort of upsurge of asthma in East Germany.
Yeah.
One explanation could be that East German physicians begin to adopt the West German medical culture and diagnose asthma more because that's part of that modernization.
Yeah.
And that might be a general trend as well. That's just to throw that out as a suggestion and continue the debate.
Yeah.
Just to come back to Marcel Proust and his parents, another angle that rather than going deeply psychoanalytic, you can borrow from Edward Shorter, who has a very interesting explanation in From Paralysis to Fatigue. He introduces two basic concepts: somatization, the tendency to translate psychological, psychogenic factors into somatic expressions, and then pathoplasticity, because there is a great avoidance of psychogenic attribution. The people don't want to be so labeled.
Yep.
And here we have it in an individual in his family.
Yep.
He knew that if he turned to his father would say, it's a nervous disease. His mother gives him sympathy because he is allowed to avoid psychogenic attribution. It presents as a somatic condition.
No, I take that point. I mean, the story of the emergence of the preponderance of psychosomatic explanations in that early 20th century is very interesting. The story of asthma in that context, because for many people, partly perhaps as a product of that sort of Proustian image, many people regard asthma as the main example of a psychosomatic condition in which that somaticization and those psychological processes were played out in terms of the asthma. No, it's a very fair point. The first one about the artifactual diagnostic shifts is interesting as well, because I think there's undoubtedly an element of diagnostic fashion that has shaped the trends. And you can see it in the British figures sometimes. And I was talking to general practitioners who were working through the 50s, 60s, and 70s. There were children coming to their clinic who were diagnosed as wheezy bronchitis in the 1950s. And by the mid-1960s, they were being diagnosed as asthmatic. And talking to them, they didn't really understand why. There were a number of papers published about asthma. There was this wave of asthma deaths, and so they were in tune, and they were alert, perhaps for the first time, to the importance of diagnosing asthma in young kids in particular, because of the potential severity and fatality of the condition. And so there was almost, in the space of a very short period of time, a diagnostic switch from just saying you've got wheezy bronchitis, you've got a bit of an upper respiratory tract infection with a bit of wheezing, to saying your child is asthmatic, to avoid all the legalistic complications of misdiagnosing and not picking it up. I think there's evidence that was a factor in rising levels of asthma in some countries, and in allergies more broadly, in fact, is that perception suddenly. For example, you can see it as well that food allergies are regarded as a minor irritation. You get one or two deaths from peanut allergies or other types of allergies, and suddenly it becomes important to diagnose it. So the diagnostic behavior of physicians changes. Most of the epidemiological evidence, and I think it's complicated, suggests that doesn't sufficiently explain the rising levels of asthma. And the argument is largely based upon the fact that if there was a changing diagnostic pattern, you would see at the same time as asthma diagnoses rising, bronchitis diagnoses falling. This was one of the debates about the asthma epidemic, the wave in the 50s and 60s, that these were actually deaths from bronchitis, not from asthma, and that we were just calling them asthma and labelling them differently. But it would appear that this is, I mean, I'm praising the sort of epidemiological argument here, that as asthma levels rose, there was no corresponding decline in the incidence and prevalence of other respiratory conditions, suggesting that this was a real phenomenon, if you like, and not just the product of a diagnostic switch. I don't, you know, I probably am on, if I read you right, I'm on your side, that there is something important about the way in which physicians operate and behave in diagnosing, and the way in which patients drive certain diagnostic categories as well. But I don't think that that explains sufficiently the trends that we've seen in allergic diseases and asthma. I think that there's still a substantive disease burden that has risen and that needs to be explained in some kind of environmental way, I think.
Anne, I think maybe you'll have to be the last one. Is there anybody else who would like to ask a question? We're not too much time, so I see Anne, 2, 3. All right, thanks. Go ahead.
First, I guess I'd like to thank the Wellcome Trust because over 10 years ago I received a Wellcome Trust scholarship to do history of medicine at Cambridge, so it was very nice. I've since gone on to do public health medicine. And I guess I have maybe more of just a technical comment or question with regard to this rise in asthma trend and some of the maybe caveats as you were mentioning about the data. Has anyone actually looked at data which is from GP reporting, which clearly has all sorts of problems, firstly in terms of access, so the poor might not have access, they might only go if it's a really severe condition, and that might not justify it, and so on. And secondly, just as you say, when people are hot,